It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we hear how leaders in Milwaukee schools are learning to handle issues of race in their classrooms.
Now it's time for our weekly check-in on the latest in Washington politics. The Senate voted down another plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. This came after Senator John McCain delivered a rebuke to his colleagues in his first time back on the Senate floor following his brain cancer diagnosis.
And President Trump is courting controversy following a speech he made at the Boy Scout Jamboree this weekend, which rankled some parents and observers. And he announced today that he will seek to ban transgender individuals from serving in the armed forces.
Callum Borchers joins us now. He covers the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. Callum, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be with you.
Well, Callum, yesterday the Senate voted to open debate on health care in Washington. Where is that effort right now?
It's sort of unclear right now, isn't it? You know, the direction could go any number of ways. We could end up with some kind of comprehensive repeal and replacement bill. We could end up with a repeal only with no replacement. We could end up with nothing at all. It's somewhat unclear, and it's also unclear exactly what Senate leadership is hoping the outcome will be. Meanwhile, the president seems just set on some kind of win. Remember that repealing Obamacare was a central campaign promise for him, and he seems less concerned about the particulars of any given proposal than he is concerned about just getting something tangible that he can show to his base.
And this has been controversial in the Senate, even among Republicans. And the debate, in fact, over health care was seen for a while as dead on the Hill for a while, and the GOP looking ahead to tax reform. And then it was revived with a new urgency, and we've seen debate opened. What was driving that urgency that we're seeing in action today?
Well, I think a big part of it comes down to a recognition that tax reform is a lot harder to do if you don't do health care first. And the two are related, of course, because Republicans, in desiring to repeal Obamacare, want to repeal, of course, the taxes that go along with Obamacare, right? So those are taxes, for example, on health insurance company CEOs and taxes on high-income earners. And so if you don't do that first, then your task becomes a lot harder when you want to reform the rest of the tax code. They feel like they can achieve a lot of savings by doing Obamacare repeal first and then moving on to tax reform.
And Senator John McCain made a special return to the Senate yesterday after his brain cancer diagnosis. He voted yes, but in some ways it's seen as contradictory to his remarks. He gave a bit of a speech where he basically rebuked the Senate and said they hadn't gotten a lot of things done and came out against the urgency to do things quickly and not deliberate thoughtfully. What do you make of what happened yesterday with John McCain?
It was quite a moment, wasn't it? I mean, it was, first of all, the round of applause that he got when he returned to the Senate floor. And then he delivered really this rousing speech, probably one of the best of his political career. And you're right. I mean, he voted yes to open debate on health care, but was extremely critical of the way in which health care reform crafting has been handled, right? Largely behind closed doors. He said that we all understand that this is really just a shell of a bill right now. There's a lot to flesh out. And he criticized his own colleagues in the Republican Party for not involving their Democratic counterparts heavily enough. Of course, he also said that Democrats did the same when they passed the Affordable Care Act in the first place. So he wasn't absolving Democrats by any means. But it was a very critical speech overall, even though, yes, he did vote in the affirmative.
Is it fair to say that Senator McCain has a special gravitas in the Senate right now? He has returned and has a brain cancer diagnosis, and yet he's still active in politics at the same time as we're seeing media pieces looking at his legacy and his contributions. What do you think of his role? Does he have more clout right now?
He does. And part of it, of course, is being kind of a heroic figure in a lot of ways for, you know, fighting the disease that he has right now and coming back to duty so quickly. But some of it, of course, goes back before that. I mean, recall that it was just a few weeks ago that, you know, we saw him in Afghanistan alongside Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, someone who, you know, is politically very different from him, obviously. And so in that sense, even before this, he has become sort of a symbol of bipartisanship or at least cordiality in the Senate, somebody who is willing to work with Democrats. And I think that a big part of it, too, is also just the contrast in his style from that of the president. You know, I focus on the press and politics, and I was writing just last week about how reporters have this appreciation for John McCain because although he has certainly jousted with the media at times, most notably during his campaign for president in 2008, he has always, or at least most of the time, done so within the norms of typical political discourse, you know, complained about, oh, I think I'm not getting enough coverage this way, or I see some bias over here, but certainly not saying you guys are the enemy of the American people like we hear from the president.
Some breaking news from the New York Times reporting that the Senate on Wednesday afternoon rejected a proposal to repeal major parts of the Affordable Care Act without providing a replacement, so that partial repeal amendment failed 54 to 45. At that point, one person yet to vote there. So there's the latest, Callum. What is your take on that?
Well, I think it's just another reminder of how things have changed now that the stakes are so real. I mean, how many times did Republicans, you know, with a snap of the finger, basically, vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act when they knew that President Obama would veto it, when they knew that such a vote was just purely symbolic? Now that they're actually the party in power, they have a hard time deciding whether that's really what they want to do without a comprehensive replacement plan in place. And so I think what we're seeing right now is a party that for years has been unified in its loathing of Obamacare, but perhaps hadn't fully thought through what the best alternative would be.
Talking Washington politics right now with Callum Borchers, covers the intersection of politics and media for The Fix at The Washington Post. And Callum, I think it was John McCain who made the point that the Senate basically took a bill, the Affordable Care Act, that wasn't very popular and made it popular. So given that, given where the public opinion stands right now, what do you think Republican senators and I suppose members in the House as well, what do they do next about health care?
Right. I thought that was a standout moment as well, because in addition to criticizing the process of putting the bill together and the substance of it, or perhaps the lack thereof in some cases, McCain really sort of slammed the messaging there, didn't he? And he basically said, look, you know, the Affordable Care Act was not tremendously popular. And yet, you know, we've presented a bill that has something like a 15% endorsement in national surveys. And in railing against Obamacare as hard as we have, without providing a popular alternative, we've actually made Obamacare more popular than it was before. And I think it's a reminder also of kind of the conspicuous absence of the president on this front in a lot of cases. You know, he has said that he is supportive of the Senate bill, but he hasn't really shown it in his actions. You know, he hasn't held a news conference, or at least a full news conference, since February. He's done those, you know, mini joint two-question conferences with other foreign leaders. But he's been out, when he's been out traveling at events, all he's been doing is slamming the Affordable Care Act without really talking up the Republican replacement plan. He hasn't used the bully pulpit, for example, to have a primetime address to the nation where he makes the case for the Republican plan and compels all the television networks to give up their primetime programming and put him on live. I mean, these are the kinds of traditional messaging tools that you would use to sell your plan. And I think that's part of what McCain was hinting at, that we haven't really done a very good job on that front.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Tony joining us in Tomahawk. Tony, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
McCain's statement on the Senate floor really was a half measure. I think what he ought to have done is just say, I'm not even going to vote to proceed, because then he went on and speechified about how everything should go through committee and have an open process. If he had voted no yesterday, there would have been, that would have forced them to go back to committee and have an open process. Now it's anybody's guess, and we have to go through all this charade of vote after vote after vote. And unfortunately, maybe something will slip through that'll be bad for the people. The other thing that keeps being said is that the, and it's a Republican talking point, that Obamacare was not debated and it was pushed through. It was debated for 1 year, and Obama himself went before a group of Republican legislators and tried to explain, you know, why the Affordable Care Act was a good idea. So to keep repeating the idea that that Obamacare was not debated, that's nonsense. I mean, it's, in terms of the context, that's not true at all.
Tony, thanks a lot for those thoughts. And starting with Senator McCain, Callum, do you think that Tony shares the thoughts of maybe some Republicans who say he had the principles in his speech, but he voted what seemed to be contrary? What did McCain himself say about why he made that vote?
Well, I think part of it was just to sort of make the process more public. I think that Tony makes a good point, and certainly other Republicans felt that way. That's why you saw a couple of Republican senators say that they weren't even going to say yes to take up the bill for debate. And that's why last week we had even more holdouts. You remember that the last time they wanted to get to this standpoint, they couldn't even get this far. I think that the argument that McCain would make, and he hinted at this in his remarks yesterday, is that at least if you vote to bring the bill to the floor for debate, and yes, you get these vote after vote, but it becomes a more public process, right? I mean, we've got something like 20 hours of debate going on. You know, you can turn on C-SPAN and watch some of it if you care to, and you get these votes, and so you get the senators on the record, where do they stand on this version or that amendment, et cetera. And so I think there is some value to conducting the process in a more public way. And I think that's one of the things that McCain helped to accomplish with his yes vote.
And we have a final update now on that partial repeal amendment vote. The final numbers are in, 55 to 45. The amendment failed. As we talk right now with Callum Borchers, he covers the intersection of politics and media for The Fix at The Washington Post.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Senate health care vote that happened last night and that just happened today? What are your thoughts on President Trump's announcement that he'll bar transgender individuals from the armed services? And what did you think of his speech at the Boy Scout Jamboree this weekend? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're getting the latest in Washington politics with Callum Borchers. He covers the intersection of politics and media for The Fix at The Washington Post.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of our current political climate? What are your thoughts on the healthcare debate in the Senate right now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's take another call on healthcare before we move on. Jill is with us next in Rhinelander. Jill, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I was just calling to say that if there is a plan that is passed by our illustrious Congress, and it's supposed to be great and wonderful, the second that plan passes, every member of our federal government that has the current insurance should switch to that plan. Let them be first. Let them be the leaders, especially our senators and our congressmen. Let them show us that it's a really good deal, and they'll give up what they've got.
Jill, thank you for that call. Seen that from other Republican critics. Callum, what do you think about Jill's comments?
It's a popular sentiment and one that is easily understandable. It's one, frankly, that has never resonated particularly strongly with me, simply because I think we need to remember that when we're talking about legislation like the Affordable Care Act or something that would replace it, you know, the idea is largely to provide insurance options for people who don't have other good ways of getting insurance, right? I mean, most people in the United States get their health insurance through their employers. They're not using Obamacare exchanges. And so I think it's a little bit of a false equivalency to say, well, why don't these senators or these congressmen sign up for health insurance through whatever exchange program they might pass in Congress, when the reality is that most of us don't either.
Well, let's look at another story making news today. President Trump announced, seems to be a rather large policy change to the military via Twitter, and that was that he's looking to ban transgender individuals from being able to serve in the armed forces. And what do we know about the origin of this shift?
Well, it's a good question. It is something that the president has thought about for a while, but seemingly hasn't entirely thought through, because the policy that he announced today is kind of vague. For example, we don't know what this means for transgender soldiers who are serving openly in the military right now. Does that mean that they are all of a sudden going to be kicked out? Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the incoming White House press secretary, was asked that very question maybe an hour or so ago at the daily press briefing, and she didn't have an answer. She said that's something that the Defense Department is still sorting out. And so you wonder, why did we get this announcement today when the specifics of the execution haven't been fully considered?
And what kind of reaction has this gotten so far?
Well, as you would expect, you've gotten a lot of opposition from LGBT rights groups. But what's been striking to me is that you've also gotten a lot of pushback from within the Republican Party. Senator Shelby from Alabama, for instance, since the Republican, coming out and saying, everybody who wants to serve ought to be able to serve. John McCain, who we were just talking about a moment ago, also came out and said that he believes that especially the soldiers who are already in the military ought to be able to continue to serve. And so this could be a case actually where the president is perhaps playing to the most committed members of his base, but is actually going to irritate a lot of other people who should theoretically be his allies.
And the president saying that the military needed to be fully focused on victory, and the implication there is that this is a distraction and that it's expensive when you look at the medical expenses.
Yes, that is the explanation. I think what's important to remember is that there is a spectrum of people who are at different stages of transitioning, right? And so I think that, what the president in that explanation is kind of holding up is this idea that, the military is going to have to be paying for, gender reassignment surgeries, these expensive medical procedures for these soldiers, when in many cases that is probably not what's going on. There are far less invasive measures that some transgender people use. They take hormone therapy at times, and others. I happen to have a good friend of mine who I used to row with when I was a semi-competitive rower in another life, who is a trans man, but born into a woman's body, and for example, chose to compete as a woman, which meant sort of no physical alterations at all. It couldn't take testosterone because that would obviously set off the drug tests. You'd fail the drug tests and be disqualified. All it meant was that in his personal life, he used a man's name, identified as a man, dated women, dressed like a man, etc. But it didn't really affect the rowing in any way. And this is a person, by the way, who was an Air Force veteran, somebody who served in the military as a woman, and it made no difference to the service. So, what do you do about folks like that? There's no additional expense in a scenario like that. And are we really going to conduct, a witch hunt, to borrow a term that the president likes to use, to kind of ferret out people like this? That's also something that is rather undefined right now.
And let's take another call on this from Ron in Norwalk. Ron, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm, sure, go ahead.
Hey, yeah, thank you. I just look at this latest issue, the transgender issue, as just another distraction. I think there's a pattern in this administration in that as soon as things get tight, like the Russia investigation or the health care, then another distraction is introduced, and it's this kind of the form of governing that this administration does. And I just think it's just has the media chasing its tail.
Ron, thank you for that thought. This has been, it's 24/7 news cycle. It has been before, but it seems as though the pace has definitely quickened since President Trump took office. But what do you think, Callum? Is this a deliberate strategy, or is this a different leader and lots of big stories, lots of changes?
I wish I could say for certain, but I do think that there is something to the distraction theory, because we have seen it before, or we've certainly appeared to see it before. You know, you get into moments when the president is confronted by unflattering news, often related to Russia, and he has a way of sort of injecting into the political discourse some controversy on an unrelated topic that is surefire way to eat up a lot of the news cycle. And I think that we're seeing some of that on display today. Certainly every moment that we talk about transgender soldiers and this vague, undefined ban right now is a moment that we're not spending talking about Russia. We're not talking about Donald Trump Jr. or Paul Manafort or Jared Kushner. I think it's quite possible that it's a strategic play.
And Kellum, as we start to wrap up, President Trump spoke at the Boy Scout Jamboree this weekend. Let's take a quick listen.
Did President Obama ever come to a jamboree?
And the crowd reacting there. I've read reports that those were boos that the president incited. I can't tell if they're answering no. It's hard to tell, but you get the tone of that clip. And this has been pretty controversial and still picking up steam. Kellum, what do you think about the president's remarks in front of the Boy Scouts?
Well, whether you liked them or didn't like them, I think it was probably indisputable that it was a very political speech. And the Boy Scouts of America felt compelled afterwards to kind of reiterate that they are a nonpartisan organization, and they tried to distance themselves from any particular candidate, public official, party, etc. And so, you know, clearly there was an element of discomfort there, at least with the organization. And it was striking the way that he came out and gave basically a classic Trump stump speech. I mean, I think he began by, blasting the fake news media and, you know, went on about Hillary Clinton. I mean, this was not the type of speech that we were accustomed to seeing presidents deliver to the Boy Scouts.
Kellum, we'll leave it there till next time. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Happy to be with you.
That was Kellum Borchers covering the intersection of politics and media for The Fix at The Washington Post. And he joined us there for our weekly check-in on the latest in Washington politics. On Monday and Tuesday of this week, a group of over 100 school leaders from across Milwaukee attended a training on how to address race and cultural differences in their schools. The professional development event was put on by Schools That Can Milwaukee, a local nonprofit. Representatives of Milwaukee Public Schools, private choice schools, and independent charter schools all attended the event.
Rashida Evans joins us now. She's a chief program officer for Schools That Can Milwaukee. Rashida, hello.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us. And also with Rashida in the Milwaukee studios is Tawana Harper. She's the academic dean at Milwaukee College Prep Lloyd Street, and she attended the two-day training event. Tawana, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So, Rashida, let's start with you. Why do school leaders in Milwaukee need to learn about how to deal with race and cultural differences?
The reality is, in Milwaukee right now, what we see is that there primarily are leaders and teachers who are standing before our students are those that don't look like our students, which is not problematic in and of itself, as long as we know that the adults who are standing and working with our kids every day are willing to get to know our kids, understand our kids, and are also really willing to confront any of the biases or their own experiences that may impact their ability to really reach our students academically and through forming positive relationships with them.
And Rashida, when you say cultural differences, what do we really mean there?
Well, in Milwaukee, you may know the facts of Milwaukee, but it's a very segregated city. And so when we're talking about students on the south side, we're typically talking about our Latino students. And when we're talking about students on the north side of Milwaukee, we're typically talking about Black students. And across both areas, there are more white teachers and leaders who are in those buildings than those that look like the students before us. And so that typically is what we're talking about right now.
And Tawana, talk with us about how you see these issues playing out where you are at the Milwaukee College Prep School.
So when I think about like being culturally responsive, Milwaukee College Prep, partnering with Schools That Can and attending the workshops, we know that that has been an issue within our schools, just because, like Rashida stated, there are more of leaders that are are white and who may not look like the students that we are servicing, and that we, you know, are really trying to change the narrative in which they come to us, into our doors. So Milwaukee College Prep has really worked hard in that, even thinking about the diversity in our leadership teams, to make sure that there are students, there are leaders that are in front of students, but also not only with that change, but building things into our daily practices, in our academics curriculum, to where as our students are able to see characters who are like them. And even when thinking about how our students, just their culture and our declaration, that they can see and they can be proud of who they are. So Milwaukee College Prep has already started that conversation. We do know that there is work still there to be done, but we have, again, already started that conversation within our schools.
And it seems like it would be important for students to see people who look like them or come from similar backgrounds who are succeeding and who are leaders in not just the school, but in the larger community.
Absolutely. What we know is that, like, we see a lot of adults, our kids see a lot of adults who, in schools, who may be working in the lunchroom, or they may be cleaning the building, and sometimes they may be disciplinarians, but we also want our students to see individuals like them who are in leadership, who are teachers, other careers as well. So bringing people on career days into the schools that look like them, like, that's important, and making sure that they're exposed to lots of different experiences and are able to see Black people and Latino people who are doing amazing things that are not always portrayed in the media.
And Rashida, I think some people might say, you know, the important thing is that teachers know the subjects they're teaching, they're good instructors, that principals, say, or other leaders in the school know best practices for education. You know, that's the most important thing. But what would you say the responsibility is of teachers and other school administrators to confront issues of race and cultural difference at school?
I think all of those things are important. I would agree with those people, but I would not end there. I think when we have issues in our city similar to what happened last summer with Sherman Park or other issues, we need adults in the building who are comfortable having conversations with our students about the realities that they're facing every day, whether they agree with them or not. We need them to be comfortable to create a safe space for students to be able to talk about those things. And that can only be done when the adults are doing the individual work to say, here's who I am. This is what I bring to the table. Who are my students? How can I get to know them? How can I get to understand what their daily lives are like as well?
We're talking with Rashida Evans from Schools That Can Milwaukee, and also Tawana Harper. She's the academic dean at Milwaukee College Prep Lloyd Street. And we're talking about a training that happened earlier this week to help leaders in schools in Milwaukee address issues of race and cultural difference. And Tawana, you attended the training. What did you go into it expecting to get out of it, or hoping to get out of it?
I would say that I was looking to just some things to take back is just how to, what's the protocol for starting the conversations? And we know that there was an elephant in the room. And what I really, like, appreciate from Schools That Can is that they allow for leaders in the city of Milwaukee to be able to have a space to start that conversation and have tools to go back. And that was one thing that I wanted to be able to do, because as an academic dean, I am over a large amount of teachers, and at times I want to make sure that I am being just very thoughtful and mindful that all teachers may not have the same background that I have, but they are here and they're ready to do that. They're ready to work hard for the students that are in front of them. So how can I very respectfully help them, support them, guide them with tools to be able to have conversations with their students, feel comfortable, not feel guilty if they have not walked the same story and a narrative of our students, but how they can have that conversation. And so that's what I really wanted to get from the training. And one thing, as Rashida spoke, is that I'm leading now going into this year is definitely starting a conversation with my teachers first to say, well, first with myself to say, who do I want to be? Where do I want to go? Where do I see myself? And how can I meet people where they are and be humble in that, knowing that I started where they were, and know that I'm not far removed from that, and nor could I can go back to that as well. But then also helping them to be able to do that same thing with themselves, the teachers, to say, who am I? Why am I here? What is my purpose? How am I meeting my students where they are? What are my students' stories? Because stories are so powerful. And the training really taught us about the presenters. They had stories. They unpacked all of their stories so that we can see that you come from somewhere, and because you come from somewhere, you come with beliefs, and that now can become your behaviors. So I want to be an academic dean. Yes, I am a person. My role is to, you know, help teachers with curriculum, but it can't just stop there. And so I want to be able to be that leader in front of my teachers, in front of my students. So that's what I've gained from the workshops, and I that's what I was going in with the open mind to gain those things.
And Rashida, 2 days of training is a fairly significant amount of time, but when you're looking at trying to address issues of race and cultural difference, you could spend years on that and still have work to do. What is the priority of the training? What do you focus on the most?
For this particular training, we wanted to be really thoughtful about doing two things. One, we wanted to balance the time between having leaders do self-reflection and look at their own being and seeing what are the beliefs that they bring to the table with students. The second thing that we wanted them to walk away with were ideas and tools for how to actually apply it in the roles that they're in. So the first day, what we saw was that for pre-work, leaders came in having completed what is called a racial autobiography, where they actually looked at themselves over their lifetime to see when did race first even become an issue for them, and maybe not even an issue, but when did they first notice race and what caused them to notice race, and then what was their most recent interaction with race even up until Monday. But then the afternoon, so after having those conversations and really reflecting internally, we spent the afternoon talking about, now how does this transfer into the work that we do every day. So we broke out groups into, we had a principal's group, we had an instructional leaders group, and then we had a dean's group. So deans are those that are typically managing school culture and student behavior, because we want them to spend some time thinking about how do those experiences impact how they manage discipline and behavior? How does it influence the policies and the procedures that are in place within the school? The same thing for the instructional leaders and the principals. What types of curriculum are in place? How are we coaching teachers, and how are we developing our people to be able to recognize when small biases show up, or even when it's unintentional? I think I tend to assume the best about people and think that most of the people who are doing work in our schools are those people who intend to do it and do it well and connect with kids. And so they may not know when biases or other issues may show up. And so we wanted to be able to prepare our leaders to be able to tackle that in real practical experiences. And we were able to do that in breakout groups Monday afternoon.
We're talking with Rashida Evans from Schools Akin Milwaukee and Tawana Harper from Milwaukee College Prep Lloyd Street about a training for Milwaukee school leaders earlier this week.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How do you think teachers and school leaders should handle issues of race and cultural differences in the classroom? If you're a teacher, how do you handle those things in school? Parents, what are you telling your kids about race and cultural differences? You can call in now at 800-642-1234, and you can also share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion about a training event earlier this week for Milwaukee teachers and school leaders about how to handle issues of race and cultural differences. We have two guests with us right now, Rashida Evans from Schools That Can Milwaukee and Tawana Harper from Milwaukee College Prep Lloyd Street.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What role do you think school teachers should play in addressing race and cultural differences for children? How are these issues handled in your community's school? What do you think teachers should do when confronted with these topics in the classroom or in the hallways? And parents, how do you talk about race and cultural difference with your kids? Call now at 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. And let's go to the phones, and Kelly in Ashland is up first. Hi, Kelly.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, so I am a white teacher, and I am identifying so much with what Rashida and I'm sorry, I forgot the other
Tawana.
Speaker's name. Tawana, I know for me as a white speaker, as a white teacher, coming into a classroom where previously I'd taught ESL, and then I moved into a school that was, most of the students were either African-American or other students of color. And even though I'd actually studied a lot of the culture, I was a Spanish speaker and things like that, that it realized that a lot of that cultural knowledge didn't transfer to my African-American students, and that I had a lot of internalized biases that I didn't even realize I had, because where I lived was a mostly white neighborhood. My family's white. I grew up in a small rural white town. And it just made me really, I had a black principal at the school, and she was really great. And it just, being at the school and being with my students, it was a real opportunity for me to look at what I didn't even know was unintentional biases, like thinking my students were really loud at first when I first started working at the school, or I got the opportunity to watch some of my black colleagues teach, and there was a call and response form of teaching that they were using that I had never seen before, but which was really successful. And when I started using it with my students, I realized that I was teaching to a very narrow band of what I knew to be education, and that there's actually a much wider band of how to reach students and what does care mean to different students. It was a really great opportunity for me as a white person and as a white teacher, but I definitely felt there were times when I was not there for my students of color in the way that I would have liked to have been.
Well, Kelly, thanks so much for sharing that experience and those thoughts with us. And Tawana, as an academic dean, you do supervise a lot of teachers. Do you see that kind of eye-opening, that epiphany happening with teachers who are in a setting where maybe a lot of the kids come from a background that's different from theirs?
Yes, I see this on a daily basis. And because I know that, I feel that, like Rishi said, people are there, like, with very good intentions. I want to assume the best. And I always go by the quote, like, people don't care about how much you know until they know how much you care. And the lady who, to me, was just on the, who called in, she really cared. She was vulnerable and willing to get to know the students who were in front of her. And I feel like when teachers come to me knowing that, you know, I am here for them and I support them, they're willing and we can work together with helping them, that when they have those times where they feel like maybe I shouldn't be here. So I deal with that on a daily basis. And I just think that if you have a leader, like she said, she had a leader who understands and supports, it's a collaborative effort. I've just seen some powerful work come from that.
I think the thing that I would add is that sometimes I think the belief, especially for our white teachers, can be that if we are talking about race or bringing up issues of race, it means that there's a belief that they shouldn't be teaching our kids or black and brown children. And that's not the reality at all. And so because we're bringing up the issue doesn't mean that we question whether they can be there or that they can be effective. It just means that it's important that each of us are willing to do the work internally to be able to reach our kids in the best possible way, and that we're willing to do the work that it takes to allow our children to be themselves in the classroom. And it means that if there are some kids who show up loud, some kids are loud, some black children are loud, some black children are not, but that we are willing to do the work to get to know each student as they are, and we're careful not to overgeneralize or not to ignore some things that are cultural, because those are real, and some things that are just specific to children. And so I think that requires us to be thoughtful in how we show up every day. But it doesn't mean that because we have work to do or because we have some things to work through in ourselves that we cannot teach all of our children. That's not what that means at all.
Thanks so much for that call, Kelly. And let's go back to the phones. And Don in Madison is up. Hi, Don.
Hi. First of all, thank you all for everything you're doing. I'm a proud Milwaukee Public School grad, so I love the work that you guys are doing in Milwaukee. And I also teach at UW-Madison. And this past semester, I got to know Nigel Hayes, the basketball player, and I had him come guest lecture in my class. And to emphasize a point you made earlier, he was very gracious with his time, answering lots of questions. And one of the things he talked about was how important it is to have diversity in leadership positions as well as in instructional positions, because as a kid, he didn't have a lot of role models growing up. And he said, you know, a lot of people look at this person who's teaching, and he pointed at me, and he goes, you know, I have great respect for him, but how helpful it would be for me to see people like myself in positions of instruction. And it's really important that we support and help build up leadership mentalities in all kinds of people. And he told stories about how he had a few people who helped nurture that and how important that was. So I just wanted to point that out about how incredibly important that is. And as a white male, I never saw that growing up until I started working a lot in American Indian communities and started realizing, you know, my frame of the world was limited. And the role models I saw, you know, as the points you guys were making earlier, looked like me, so I didn't even think of it until I started putting myself in the position of the Native kids I was working with. And really, it opened my eyes a lot to how important it is to have good mentors and good role models from all different ethnicities and communities.
Don, thanks so much for that call. And Rashida, it sounds like, you know, people who are exposed to these kind of eye-opening and perspective-shifting experiences really learn a lot from it and really embrace it.
I think that is the case. I think when people are willing to do the work, they're surprised at just how eye-opening it is. I think one of the biggest takeaways, and this can be from a racial perspective or even from a socioeconomic perspective, is that everybody's American dream is different. And I think that sometimes in the classroom, our goal is to push our children towards one American dream, and without realizing that they may have their own dreams that may very well different from what is a traditional white American dream. And I think we need to honor that. I think our goal behind having conversations about race or talking about culturally responsive pedagogy is that, like, our kids are prepared for whatever, and so that they are free to make the choice to live however they choose to live. And I think that is the biggest piece of all of this for me.
Rashida, do you think this type of training being of use is unique to Milwaukee, or is it something that all educators in Wisconsin could benefit from?
I definitely think it's something that all educators could benefit from. I don't think there's ever any harm in people taking the time to get to know other people. I think it honors everybody who exists. And I think sometimes, without realizing it, we can just assume that everybody is working towards the same thing, or everybody's existences or experiences are the same. And that's just not the reality for everyone. And I think taking the time to get to know other people and to invest in other cultures, I think it just makes us better people all around. And I think whether it's in the field of education, if it's in the business world, there's never any harm in being willing to do that.
Just briefly, as we wrap up, how do you think this training might look different in a community where maybe it's 95% or more white population?
I think it could actually look the same. And I think we happen to be talking about race this week. I think there are other issues that we could tackle just as deeply. And I think even if it was a school that was 95% white, I think there's still value in having people explore the biases that they bring, because the world isn't 95% white. And I think we need to be prepared for what's in the world. We talk about a global economy a lot. Even if we just look within our state, like we this state is diverse. While it is segregated, it is also diverse. And I think there is value in having any group of people spend time doing the internal work to be able to accept other people as they are.
Well, Tawana, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Rashida, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you for having me.
Rashida Evans is Chief Program Officer for Schools That Can Milwaukee, and Tawana Harper is Academic Dean at Milwaukee College Prep Lloyd Street. They joined us to talk about training for race and cultural difference in Milwaukee. Summer's about halfway over, and Veronica, you and I were talking earlier that we have a lot left to do on our warm weather to-do list.
Right. It just flies by. It happens every year. Every year, actually, in the last couple of years, we've gotten the habit of making a to-do list, the kids and I and my husband and also my mom, about what we want to do. And, you know, I think we looked at it yesterday. We've crossed out one thing.
What was that one thing?
What was it?
Was it make the vacation to-do list?
Oh. Yeah, maybe it was. I can't remember what it was right now. But we've done one thing on our list. What about you, Judith?
So I am not even organizing have to have a list, but I have things that I think, oh, I really want to do that. One is I actually have this rather large scale, ambitious plan to move things around in my garden, which, you know, it's a whole domino effect. So there's that. I've gotten a start on it. But one thing is we actually bought ourselves a rack for our bikes, and we haven't really used it yet to actually drive somewhere with our bikes and then bike in an area that we don't know. So that's high on my list.
And there's so many bike trails in Wisconsin.
And I need to find out about those ones that are farther.
We got to do something on that. Well, also kayaking, that's definitely on my list. I did finally go stand-up paddleboarding for the first time ever. Although, in full disclosure, I sat down paddleboarding. Because it was really windy. It was really fun, though.
It's probably safer that way.
Yeah, that was a nice one to do. And also hitting up Blue Mountain State Park for a picnic. The views are so incredible there. So got to make it out there before summer's over.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.